Hey, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome back to the second episode of A Day in the Life of the Digital Anthropologist. Today, we have an excellent and a great anthropologist, and I'm excited to introduce Elizabeth Brody. How are you, Elizabeth?
Hi,
So
thank
happy
you.
to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. So today, we have an exciting podcast. Like I said in the first episode, I'm excited to dive into digital anthropologists, day in the life, and I'm curious about what are they doing in the daily life, what is the routine, the research method that they use, or anything just related to their work. So I guess I would like if you could give me an introduction of yourself and a little background of who you are and what do you do.
Okay, well, I'm Elizabeth Brody. I'm trained as a cultural anthropologist, became a business anthropologist after I finished my graduate school. And most recently, I have been working on helping students figure out ways in which they can manage the job search process and land the kind of job that they feel they would like to do.
That's great. Yes, that's how I actually met you through LinkedIn when I was still in the early stages of the nonprofit that I founded. I was looking to find more digital anthropologists or people who are in the field. And by definition, business anthropology and all that falls into, digital anthropology. And I saw an event that it was going to be happening at Fordham University in New York City. I correct me if I'm wrong, it was 22, 2002, right?
2022.
22. Okay, yes. And we're still in the pandemic. So I saw that and I was so excited to get out of Florida. So I did so I registered for that mini conference. To now I feel like that was the best conference I attend to. And I hope that you bring it back or you guys bring it back because it was so helpful. I gained so much knowledge and I wish all the anthropological conference were like that because the amount of information that I gained from that conference got me to, I guess, to the point that I am now. I'm more confident in the position that I am. And I got to network and create connections with so many great, applied anthropologists and also, professors in the academic and industry. And then I still talk to them. And I think we have formed like a beautiful family in Akron. And we get to meet every month. And hopefully we get to expand this awesome organization. And everybody takes get to have a little take on this and experience because I think this organization is very great, right?
Yeah, thank you. ACORN is the organization that we're talking about, and it stands for the Anthropology Career Readiness Network. So we call it ACORN, even though it's ACRN, but it's close enough. And ACORN was started in 2021 with the goal of improving the way st anthropology students are prepared for careers. And towards that end, we started building resources. We created a blog. We have a speakers bureau. We do consulting with academic departments of anthropology to help them make practice a more visible part of their programs. We just this past Friday came out with a workbook, which is called Career Tools for Anthropology, which helps students and people in career transition, typically from academia to industry or nonprofits or government, to have tools at their fingertips that can help them think about the kind of work they'd like to do, network into those communities, and then ultimately, hopefully, land the position they're looking for.
That is great. I'm really looking forward to get my copy. Like I mentioned before, I'm going to be ordering it soon. And I will definitely be going to be posting a review. It's going to be great because I know I'm looking forward for that book. That's is for what I read. And I saw the sample. This is the kind of book like everybody should have in their library. Either you are in high school, you are an undergrad, or just graduated, or you're like very advanced in your career in the anthropology field, or thinking about doing the switch, I think this is like a good base book that can give you the paths. And also says a little, I think there's a bunch of like research and some like articles that other people like reading about it, about different fields that they are in. So I think that's very insightful to read and get to know, like, how if you decide to become an applied anthropologist or changing from academics to apply or from applied to academics, you have that in the back of your mind and you understand what the field is like. So,
Exactly.
yeah, so great. So now we're gonna go to the questions. So they're gonna be easy. I just wanna get to know you as a digital anthropologist. I wanna get to know, what do you do? And this is the whole point of this podcast. We wanna learn, understand, and just see what it's like to be a digital anthropologist for a day. So the first question is like, what time do you typically wake up, and what is your morning routine as a digital anthropologist or anthropologist?
My preference when I get up is to start writing because I'm usually working on some article, book chapter, something. And I'm most awake in the morning and part of the afternoon. And so that's when I like to allocate time to writing. So many meetings that I have, I try to put in the afternoon time frame and sometimes in the evening. And
Awesome.
all my meetings are via Zoom.
Oh, great. So you're definitely a morning person. I am not. I'm a nighttime person. I work the best at 2 a.m. No, just kidding. So, everybody has a different type of, the way it work. So you say that you like to write and do your articles in the morning. So what time do you typically wake up? Like 7 a.m., 6 a.m.?
It really varies. It depends on if I have worked late the night before. And it also depends, like last week I had COVID. So, that threw me for a loop. I would say I usually get started about 9 o'clock, and usually work for a few hours and then have lunch and then get back to it. And try to integrate meetings in the afternoon as much as I can. And then in the early evening, I'll also sometimes have meetings.
Great. So you mentioned that you write articles in the morning, try to have meetings the afternoon. Are you currently employed as a professor at university? Are you freelancing? What is your current position or job position, if you don't mind telling us?
Yeah, well, I have my own consulting practice, which is called Cultural Keys. But honestly, I haven't done any work since for about a year, and I'm really at retirement age. So, if a project comes along, I would probably contribute to it in some way and find some other people to work with me on it. But if I'm not actively looking for work because my preference at this stage in my life is to be leading this effort with Acorn to help students and help instructors so that we can have an anthropology community that is far more receptive to anthropological practice, than has been the case in the past.
Oh, interesting. How do you think you interact with online communities, and what the roles do this community plays in your research when you're, doing research for either a special project or for Akron?
I spend an awful lot of time online in meetings, and some of those are directly related to projects that I'm working on. Not all of them are research projects, but some of them are. And mostly I find ways to converse with people to give me some ideas to help me think through issues, and then access resources that they may have sent me, citations they may have sent me. So I think that that's the way in which I use online opportunities.
Awesome. And then as you are running Akron, you are one of the executive directors or one of
Yeah, we
the
call ourselves co-chairs.
coaches?
So there are
Okay.
three of us. It's me, Ryle Nolan, who is an emeritus professor at Purdue University, and Jennifer Studebaker, who currently works in a nonprofit.
Great. So as a coach director, what would you say is your duties? What are things that you have to do? Do you have a specific routine that you go through? What it's like to be a coach director in a nonprofit?
We talk quite a bit and quite frequently about upcoming activities and initiatives that we're planning. So, for example, for the last 4 months, we've been fairly focused on the workbook that just came out. Prior to that, we were working with a membership group of the American Anthropological Association. These are institutional members. So the department would have the membership, the anthropology department would have the membership. And we were working with them to try to understand what they would find helpful in what ACORN could provide them in terms of resources. So we settle on some set of initiatives and then we implement them. Another recent initiative, which we created in 2023, was a consulting arrangement between us and university departments who are interested in integrating practice into their programming. So, to become a participant in this program, the anthropology department has to fill out an application form and then meet with us and talk with us briefly about what their program consists of now and where they would like to see it headed, where they see the greatest needs, what students are voicing concerns over, what the faculty are concerned about, and so on. And then we make a site visit to that campus. We stay there for 2 to 3 days. We work intensively with the members of that department to arrive at a set of tasks that they will complete over the next 12 months. And when we leave, they have a plan to complete those goals that they've set for themselves. So we then meet with them quarterly for 12 months to follow up on their progress as they try to complete all the tasks that they set out for themselves. And
Wow.
that program has been amazingly helpful. We are finishing up work with the University of Delaware, which was the first program we worked with. That's an undergraduate-only program. And now we are about to embark on three other programs, some of which have graduate programs and some of which do not. And so it'll be interesting to have that mix of both undergraduate students and graduate students from the same school with the same set of faculty and staff assisting them, supporting them. And we'll see how their goals might be similar or different to what the first program was.
Wow, that's excellent. So definitely, if you are part of a university interested in collaborating with Miss Elizabeth Brody, we definitely she's going to be sharing her contact, and definitely something that I think all your students will get a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience in something that's very important. The next question will be, what are the biggest challenges you face in your work, and how do you overcome them, either with other nonprofit or your freelance work?
The problem that I have faced throughout my career is a very simple one. Change is hard. Organizations, institutions, people, they all find it difficult to make changes to the ways in which they have been doing the work that they've been doing. And it takes a lot of work to try to help them make the changes that they say they want to make. And sometimes you're not always as successful as you would like to be. You know, people have big goals, big ideas, but then, you know, things get too complicated, or they don't have enough time, or something else takes priority. And so oftentimes what we see is that the changes that were envisioned don't always get implemented. And that to me is a bit sad, but certainly expected, because you know we only have so much energy and so much time in the course of a week or a month, and sometimes other things do take precedence. So I think that's the biggest challenge that I face, is helping organizations overcome whatever challenges are in their way, and then try to keep them on track towards their goals.
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes resistance to transformation or digital transformation or adjusting to a different like ways of doing business or something that need to change within the business structure takes a little time because they're accustomed to their own style of doing business. And when somebody
Sure.
comes like you have to do it this way, it's gonna better. Sometimes there's sort of resistance. But yeah, I hope, yeah, that's one, I agree, totally agree with you. I think that's one of the situations that need to, hopefully will change with time. What do you think is, or like when you do a freelance job work, it's in business anthropology, what is the estimate time or how do that works? Like, so for the people who's not in digital anthropology or just anthropology at all, what do you think they should be expecting? Like when you start a project, it depends if it's like small, medium, or large in your experience. What do you think is for, let's talk about a small project. What is the timeline? What are the hats that they have to wear if they're doing as a freelancer and they don't have a team? Yeah, if you can walk us through like five steps of what is like a project will work, like will be.
Well, in my own work is mostly in the area of research. So that means that all projects start with some basic research about what's going on in that particular organization. My area of expertise is organizational culture and change. And so I try to help these organizations change in the ways in which they feel they would like to change, assuming that that is possible, and yeah, assuming that it's feasible. And so I go in, and often with others, and we collect some data. It's completely above board in the sense that the senior people in that organization know that we are collecting data, and often they will help us select some people to talk to do interviews with, or to use as point persons who can direct us to others who might have special areas of expertise or experience worth sharing about the particular project topic. So oftentimes the research involves interviews, often which can usually be done via Zoom. You know, if you have the travel funding, you also go to the site, where you have an opportunity to meet people face to face and actually visit the work environment and make observations and perhaps participate in meetings. But so much changed with COVID that a lot of my work since COVID has really been just through Zoom. But we do interviews. We will take a look at the websites of these organizations to try to identify how does the website come across, and is it consistent with what we're learning in the interviews? You know, how idealistic is it? If it is idealistic, do you get the same feeling from the website that you get from the people that you're talking to? And then one other form of data collection that works extremely well when you are working by Zoom is a technique that I developed, which is asking people to do drawings. And so the technique is quite simple. You ask them to describe something that's going on in their organizations. For example, you might ask them, tell me about your interactions with your coworkers. What are those like, you know, when you're working on a project together? And then usually the person will respond and say, well, you know, I have this is how it works with us. This is how we get the work done. And they have some set of explanations. Then the second question is, okay, do you have a piece of paper handy? Yes. Okay, would you please draw a picture of what you just said? And so you know that they've just said something, and they know they've just described interactions on a work team. But now you're asking them to put it into a visual format. And usually the immediate reaction is, oh, no, I can't. I'm not an artist. I can't draw. And so, you know, you have to calm them down and say, don't worry, we're not interested in artistic excellence. Stick figures are just fine. And you have 1 minute. And all of a sudden, they realize, oh my God, they're on the clock. They have 1 minute to complete a drawing.
No pressure.
It's pressure. And they do. They complete that drawing in 1 minute.
Wow.
It's fascinating. And then you say, okay, can you show me what you just drew? And so they hold their drawing up to the camera on their laptop, and you can see it. And then you ask later if they'd send you a copy of it. But then you say, okay, now tell me what you have drawn. And they will start describing what their picture is about. So you've got three forms of data that you've just collected virtually. You've asked them to describe the interactions on their work team. You've got a drawing that represents some aspect of that, and you have their description of their drawing. So you have three pieces of data, and it turns out that with each successive piece of data, you get more detail. The drawing gives you more detail than the original description. And the final description of the drawing gives you more detail than the drawing.
Wow.
So it's an amazing technique, and it works beautifully over Zoom. And what's more, it's fast. You get the whole thing done in about, I'd say, 5 to 7 minutes. So you could actually solicit two drawings in a half-hour interview if you wanted to. So let's say that you had a project where you were trying to see how people perceive changes over time. The first drawing might be, you know, talk to me about how it was like in the past at your workplace. And then they go through the drawing, and then they explain their drawing. And then the second question would be, Okay, now I want you to think about what would you like the future of your workplace to be? What would that be like? And then they start imagining all the things that they would really like to have in a workplace. And then they draw you a picture, and then they explain their picture. So now you have a comparison built in to a half hour interview, and you've still only taken somewhere between 15 and 20 minutes to get both those drawings and the descriptions. So
Wow.
it's a marvelous way to collect data virtually. And it turns out that people love doing this. They're so excited to show you their pictures and explain why they drew what they drew, because they're all different in many ways. But the interesting thing is that if you do that with enough people in a work team or in an organization, you will see patterns. The drawings start to look alike. They have the same kind of thematic content. And so it's very easy to see how people think about their organization based on their descriptions and the drawings. So you have a ready-made understanding of the organizational culture in a way that is totally innovative and so much fun for the interviewees that I've really latched onto this, and I'm using it as often as I can.
Wow, that's super interesting. I love it. Totally love it. I'm gonna start using it. So let me ask you something. Now, you're describing a digital research methods. What are you doing? And the interviews via Zoom. Do you find that the participants are more open to talk to you or disclose certain information that they would not do that in person?
I honestly don't find a difference. You might think there could be a difference, and it maybe would make sense, just as an ordinary person thinking, oh, I'm not going to talk to somebody over Zoom. I'm not going to tell them all my thoughts and, how I feel about the world. But it turns out that if you build rapport well right from the start, people just want to talk. They want to tell you about their lives. They want to tell you about how things are and why they think they are that way. And with the drawing helps to elicit a different set of information that you wouldn't have had access to. It's one thing to hear somebody say, that they find their colleagues to be, friendly and outgoing. But it's a totally different thing when they can draw a picture of that. And maybe that picture is a group of friends walking on a beach under a sunny sky. And so you really get a sense of connection and how the people conceptualizes the value of their colleagues by the ways in which they draw their colleagues.
Wow, super interesting. Love it. I totally love it. Have you done a lot of participant observation, like when if you were in person before COVID?
Yes.
Yes. like just observing what are like, for example, if you go to a company and just observe what the secretary does to what the CEO does in the daily life, just observing, just to get a sense of who they are, what's their culture in all that.
Yeah, mostly it's not individual observation. It's more meetings that happen where I'm invited in, and I usually sit along the wall, or if appropriate, I'll sit at the table. And I sometimes participate. I get introduced, and people know why I'm there. And when I talk with them, I say, I will be taking some notes, but please don't let that bother you. That's kind of what anthropologists do. So that would be a situation where people knew who I was and why I was there. In another kind of participant observation, more on the observation side than the participant side, I have spent time in emergency waiting rooms. And in that case, the staff might know why I was there, but the incoming patients don't know who I am. And there, my purpose is to try to understand how do things happen in the emergency room? You know, what is the process that is usually followed? What happens to those patients during that process? How are they treated? How are they prioritized for treatment? And then if something very unusual happens, like there's a trauma case that comes in, what happens to the patients who've been sitting there for several hours waiting to be seen? Well, of course, they're going to wait now because there's a trauma person who's ahead of them. So anyway, I've spent a lot of time under those circumstances as well, where it's mostly observation and recording what happens. So timestamps are very important. What happens? Who talks? Who doesn't talk? What the process seems to be. And then, of course, you can take that information and you can go and talk with staff people and say, okay, this is what I observed. Is this how it usually goes? And they may correct you and say, well, no, you missed a step, or no, it usually has these other features to it that you aren't able to see because you were sitting way back in the waiting room, and these other things are going on behind closed doors when we take a patient into triage, or when we, you know, when we're doing, you know, some testing on them.
Interesting. And for the time length, like what is the timeline for the shortest projects that you've done and the timeline for the longest projects that you have done?
Oh, the shortest project was probably just a couple of weeks, and that was mostly an analysis of documentary data. So it consisted of pre-existing reports that this organization had, as well as their website, and some assessments by employees. And that was quite brief. I want to say around 3 weeks. And then the longest project I've ever worked on, sorry, I don't quite see it there on my bookshelf, but the longest project I worked on was one at General Motors when I was working there full time, and that project kicked off in 2002, and we published a book in 2010. So we were collecting data between 2002 and 2005. And then after that, we analyzed and created a bunch of tools. And then ultimately, we wrote the book.
Wow, I gotta look
So
at your book.
that one was called Transforming Culture. Why I don't have it around, but.
Okay, so what do you find the most rewarding about your role as an applied anthropologist? I know you've been a professor, and now you are doing the nonprofit. What, or just in general, what is the most rewarding about the anthropology field for you?
I think what anthropology teaches you, among many things, is that you have to be able to build rapport and relationships with people in order to understand where they're coming from. If you can't do that for whatever reason, because you are very introverted, because you find it difficult to talk with a particular group of people. You don't have the right language skills. You don't like those people for whatever reason. Then you can't do a good piece of work. So you must meet people where they are. You must develop empathy. and try to understand where they're coming from, what their life story is, what they want to talk to you about. And then once you get that established, there's the beginnings of a strong relationship that, if revisited over time, even on some of these projects, you can run into the same person again, for on some other issue or matter. And when you do, it's like, it's like seeing an old friend. So that is one of the most powerful aspects of anthropology, just the ability to get to know people and understand their worldview.
Great. And what would be the best advice you have received and that helping you in your career? And what advice would you give to someone like at all levels, entry, medium, like senior career, who's interested in apply, anthropology or digital anthropology?
Well, I can give you the same advice my professor gave me, which was if you become an anthropologist, you can do whatever you want. If you are interested in religion, you can research religion. If you are interested in economics, you can research businesses. If you are interested in politics, you can look at, the political activities, elections, governmental administration, so depending on where your interests lie, you can focus your attention on whatever appeals to you. And that in part makes anthropology so versatile. So that then allows anthropologists to work in many different work environments. You're not restricted to working. If you study economic anthropology, you're not restricted to working in a single place. You can be a consultant. You can be have a full-time job. You can work for the federal government, the state government, the municipal or regional governments. You can be an academic. You can work for a think tank. You can work for a foundation. I mean, there are many, many options. So I would say, follow your heart. Where do you think you will enjoy working? And for me, I wanted to learn how people did work differently in different parts of the world. I was fascinated by the concept of work, and it didn't matter to me who was doing it. So for my master's thesis, I studied janitors. For my dissertation, I studied farm workers. And right before that, I did a big study of Catholic sisters and priests and Catholic parish life. After I left graduate school, I worked at General Motors and I worked there for 24 years. And there I studied people who took overseas assignments, people who sold cars and trucks, people who made cars and trucks, designers, engineers, business people. People who planned activities within the company, just a variety of different kinds of people. So there I had really an opportunity to study whatever kind of occupational specialty I might have been interested in. And then after I left GM, I went out on my own and created my Cultural Keys consulting practice. And there I've had an opportunity to work in other industries, not just automotive, which is all I did before when I worked at GM, but many other industries like insurance and petrochemicals and hospital work and so on.
Wow.
So that would be my advice. Pick something that really appeals to you and then look for career paths within that area of interest that you have.
Yeah, everything now in the digital is possible. Even though me, like me, I find out about digital anthropology. I didn't even know. It was like my passion with technology, and I wanted to continue to do anthropology. And then I found out the magic word, digital anthropology, merge both of them. So the next question will be, how do my when you used to, work, or when you do work for in the nonprofit or for your freelance, how do you maintain work-life balance in the field that is so deeply connected to the digital world?
Do you mean when I'm doing field work?
Yeah.
There is no work-life balance when you're doing field work. There just isn't. It's all work. And the
Okay.
reason why is because time is money. And so you have to maximize the amount of time that you have when you're doing the field work because you are only there for a set period of time and you've got to get the data. And you may not have an opportunity to return and be restricted to just gathering information by phone or by Zoom call or something like that.
Okay. So for the students or people who stay undergrad, what it will be like the hours they will think about working, when they're doing these kind of projects, like 10 to 12 hours a day or 20, like
Oh
what?
yeah, at least that much. You
Okay.
know, and I have a rule for myself, which is a very difficult rule to follow. And that is if I have done, a series of observations and interviews on a particular day, and then I leave the work site and I go back to my hotel, I have to make sure I get all of my notes done before I go to sleep. And that takes many more hours. So the workday is not over for me when I leave the office or the plant floor or wherever I've been doing the work.
And I
Now,
want to ask these questions because, it's very important for them to, like, for everybody who's outside to understand that it's not like some jobs that have like a 9 to 5, but the job of a digital anthropologist or applied anthropologist or academic is different, has different routines and time periods and, the other jobs. So that's why, I wanted to ask you, what is it, that they should be expecting, someone who has
Right.
much experience like you've done it all. So we want to know, what should we be expecting, and also, if you think that you cannot put out that amount of work, maybe this is not the field for you, or, try to stick to a 9 to 5 job.
Right. Well, and I think it's different for a consultant compared with a full-time employee. If you are employed full-time and you are using your research skills, on the job, then you probably will have more of a 9 to 5 or 8 to 5 schedule. Though, again, it depends on how critical you are of yourself. I always felt it was very, very important to get those field notes done every single night. Because if you let it go, even 24 hours later, you've already forgotten important information. You just can't recall it. And I've had to learn that when you are at a place like General Motors, there no tape recorders are allowed. You can't bring along a tape recorder. They're not allowed for a variety of reasons, but the most important reason when you're in a manufacturing plant is there's too much noise in the background, and you couldn't, even if you put the tape recorder on, you couldn't hear anything. So I had to learn to adapt to taking notes very quickly in shorthand and then translating them at a later date. And if I let it go even 24 hours, I would not remember everything or even half of what I had learned.
Right.
And in
Okay.
these kinds of projects, they're critically important that you don't even know what's important. So you have to remember everything. You got to write it down because that then becomes your data.
Yeah, definitely. That's something that it needs to be transcribed like right to the dot. And yeah, you will think that we know it now in the digital age, we can record everything. But like you
No,
mentioned,
you.
in a in a like General Motors place like that, you know, with the whole sun. No, it's been the background, it's gonna be difficult, and yeah, and other things too. Okay, so let's talk about collaboration. Do you work more independently? Do you collaborate with other research institutions or communities?
Usually I'm collaborating with the organization with whom I'm working. And so the client has a problem, and I come in either myself or with others, and we try to address the problem. So we try to figure out what's going on. Is the problem exactly as the client stated it to be, or was it a little bit different? Was it a bigger problem? Was it a slightly, is there a different slant to the problem, different explanation for the problem? And so we spend a lot of time independently and then together, sharing what we've learned and trying to make sense out of what our individual data is telling us, and then collectively, what the collective sets of data are telling us. So there are multiple sets of field notes that we're dealing with, not just our own.
Okay, interesting. Now, this is a question that when I was transitioning from my previous career to this one, I'm still doing, trying to, you know, research it, Google it, but there's not really a great answer to it, and it's very important for everybody just to have an understanding. What can someone expect in terms of compensation when starting out as an anthropologist, applied anthropologist? Entry level, mid level, senior level, working for a company, and also what you should be expecting if you are freelancing.
Well, I think when you're working for a company, the big difference with freelance is that you have a steady paycheck. So you're going to be, when you negotiate your salary, you and your employer agree on what your pay rate is going to be, and then that's what you get paid. When you are a consultant, and you have your own shop, as I do, you get paid when you have a project, and you don't always have a project. Or sometimes you're juggling multiple projects simultaneously, and that can be very challenging. So, I think that if you are the type of person that wants to be able to rely on let's call it a normal income stream, then, full-time work is what you want. If you are someone who prefers greater flexibility or needs greater flexibility because you're raising children on your own, or, whatever your own personal circumstances are, then maybe consulting is the way to go. And you just get very good at saving money and being careful on how you spend it.
And in terms of a number, because you can't really, like, when you research, like, what compare, like, what should a digital anthropologist or anthropologist should be earning, there's not like a, you know,
There
for
isn't,
an
there's
idea.
no number. I mean, you have some anthropologists that are making, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars a year if they are senior people in their company. And then you have others who are just starting out who are, trying to put bread on the table and everything in between. I would say that for someone coming out with a PhD who gets hired by a full-time firm, you're probably going to be making over 100,000. But again, it's going to vary. You certainly will be making more if you work in industry, government, or nonprofits than if you work in a university as a young assistant professor.
Okay, but that's if you're in the like academic field, right?
If you're in academics, you will earn less than if you are in a new PhD in industry or government or nonprofits. Yes.
And then as a freelancer, it's
As a freelancer, it depends. I mean, some freelancers do very, very well because they are always out there, looking for new clients. As you are working on a current project, you already have to be thinking about, okay, what's my next project? So if you don't mind that, and that kind of is a challenge to you, an entrepreneurial challenge, then I say go for it.
okay. So you mentioned that you work on nonprofits. Would you recommend like upcoming students or somebody who's thinking about joining this field to really in-depth their knowledge and expertise in grant writing? Because that's going to be a huge part of their funding.
Well, they would need to learn how to write grants. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's an important skill to have. And it's one that it matters enormously to, especially to nonprofits. If you are working in industry, usually, no, well, I can't say usually, but oftentimes you are centrally funded. And in other cases, you are expected to deliver business to clients and reach certain standards of performance. So it really does vary enormously.
Right, correct. So now we're down to our last two questions. And one of the last ones would be like, where do you see the field of digital anthropology heading in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think there's going to, as some people have already talked about, like Mad Arts, it's we need to become much more conversant in AI and where AI is taking us, the challenges of AI, the good things about AI, and how that will help anthropologists to work smarter, better, more effectively, while taking into account the difficulties of using AI. So I think that's definitely an area of the future. There will always be organizations around that need help. They will need help not just with their employees, which is where I specialize, but they will need help with their consumers, their users, their big customers, their partners, their suppliers. There's always issues that happen along the supply chain and then out to the customer. So many times those issues are fester within a company, and anthropologists are asked to come in and try to figure out what's going on here and how can we make improvements. Many anthropologists now are working in user experience where they're helping rethink how websites are set up so that the user has a better experience using the website. It makes sense to them.
Right. I totally agree. As someone who's in, digital anthropology and AI, I did not join this field knowing anything about AI data science. I just had a big passion for technology, but then, couldn't find a program. So I just self-taught and educate myself. And there's a lot of courses out there that if you're, undergrad anthropologist or just curious or whatever level you are, if you want to be in this field, I highly suggest that, it's a course, like it's a class, you can take it on your own pace. And it's, very important. So if like undergrad, instead of taking random electives, you should just be taking some, data science, machine learning, big data, artificial intelligence, and all that. Yeah, I totally agree with you, Elizabeth, on that one.
Yeah.
And the last question will be the daily reflection. At the end of the day, how do you wind down and what do you do to reflect on and after they're working in the field of just general anthropology or digital anthropology? What is your routine? Like, you have had some tea, just read a book, or just like anything that you want to share?
Well, it depends on how tired I am, and how focused I am upon the research. I try to get the research out of my head and just kind of settle down and read a book, or put a little TV on or something like that, just as a change of pace.
That's good. Great. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been an awesome talk. I learned so much, and I'm sure all our listeners and viewers are going to be excited about, your interview. And I'm sure you're going to get a lot of questions from, just students, people who are curious about it. Would you like to share your social media platform so how they can reach to you if they want to get in contact with you?
Sure, if they would message me on LinkedIn, that would be the best way, I think. But please include a message. Don't just connect, because I won't necessarily know why they want to connect. So if they would reference the podcast, that would be good.
Awesome. And they can find you by your name, like Elizabeth
Yep,
Brioni.
Elizabeth Brighty. Yep.
Awesome. And if they're interested in Akron, the
Acorn, they can go to Anthro Career Ready. Dot net, all one word, Anthro Career Ready.
that name. Awesome. So I'm sure we're going to be hearing more projects that you guys are working on. And then hopefully, we get to organize another awesome conference like the one on 22, 2000.
Net.
That I loved it. I learned so much. And then you have some of the videos, right? The presentations that were given
Oh,
on.
yeah, they're all on the website.
Yeah. So
Yep.
if you're interested and want to know what I'm talking about, make sure you log in into that website and you're going to just definitely enjoy it. I love it. I watch it from time to time because, I mean, it was such a great day. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much, too. I appreciate it. Okay, Scarlett, take care.
Bye.
Bye.